Hello, and welcome to Week in Review, your weekly roundup of news and analysis from OnFIF around the world. I'm Julie Levier-Vignoli. Today, we're talking about central bank independence, how to escape a recession, and debt sustainability. All that and more coming right up. And welcome to this edition of Week in Review. We published a pair of pieces this week on central bank independence, which has always been an important topic and is currently the subject of many conversations as central banks employ extraordinary measures to respond to the coronavirus crisis. John Redwood, a member of the UK Parliament, wrote, "There is no such thing as an independent central bank. They are all the creatures of the states that own them. To those who thought otherwise, the coronavirus is changing the reality and rhetoric. Central banks and treasuries are working together to offset the economic damage of lockdown and closures. This is a new and welcome era of collaboration between governments and central banks. In some democracies, a myth has grown up in recent decades that their central banks are independent. A small team of dedicated officials are viewed as better equipped than elected politicians to make crucial decisions about interest rates, money, and credit. These officials are in various ways placed outside the normal political exchanges that characterize a lively democracy. This view has been particularly prevalent in the European Union, where so-called central bank independence was incorporated into the treaties as a requirement of economic and monetary union. It has worked out differently in practice. In the past few weeks, the Fed and other leading advanced country central banks have been rightly working closely with their governments on joint monetary and fiscal packages. They are trying to offset the huge hit to incomes and output from pandemic-hindering shutdowns. It is time to call time on the notion of an independent central bank and to welcome a new era of open collaboration between central banks and finance ministries serving the same state." Our US chairman, Mark Sobel, also wrote about central bank independence, focusing on the Federal Reserve. Mark says that debates on central bank independence are often caricatures, lacking nuance between those suggesting that central banks are unaccountable and have unfettered freedom, and those suggesting central banks should be subordinated to governments. What is important is that central banks, such as the Federal Reserve, make their own monetary policy decisions. They must do so in the context of clear rules and frameworks between the roles of central banks and treasuries, as well as fiscal and monetary policies. The Fed operates in a well-defined accountability framework. Board members are appointed by the US President and approved by the Senate. The Fed's dual mandate is legislatively enshrined. The Fed chair is required to testify twice a year before Congress. In short, the Fed does not independently set its goals nor determine its leadership. It does, however, alone set its monetary policy instruments. Yet, the Fed's ability to set monetary policy could face perilous challenges due to the pandemic. Many pundits, rightly lauding the Fed's rapid response to coronavirus, observe that new Fed facilities potentially entangle the central bank in such activities as Main Street, corporate, municipal, hedge fund, and private equity lending. Such lending, well beyond the central bank's traditional ambit, blurs distinctions between fiscal and monetary policies, and might put the Fed in the unwanted position of differentiating between illiquid and insolvent non-financial firms and picking winners and losers. To some extent, these issues can be managed. They are born from crisis. Confronting fiscal dominance and financial repression could be more worrisome. Fiscal dominance could arise because future US government debt and deficits were so large as to compel Fed monetary policy to take solvency concerns into account, rather than focusing exclusively on the dual mandate. Accordingly, financial repression could entail keeping interest rates far below the nominal growth rate to help bring debt to GDP and deficit ratios down. The Fed, justifiably, has a sterling reputation. It focuses responsibly on achieving its dual mandate through its technical expertise. It delivers good outcomes and creatively steps up during crises, as it is now doing. Yet, the blurring of fiscal and monetary policy, fiscal dominance, financial repression, and politicians' irresponsibility could threaten to compromise the Federal Reserve. And if you want to hear more from Mark, you can listen to his podcast on global financial stability with Fabio Natalucci, Deputy Director of the Monetary and Capital Markets Department at the International Monetary Fund, which is available to download on our website. It's not uncommon for people to compare the crisis that is unfolding to the last major financial crisis in 2008. Our economist, Chris Papadopoulos, wrote about lessons from the 2010s that will help avert another slow recovery as lockdown measures are eased. First, wrote Chris, avoid collective saving. If one sector tries to raise its surplus by cutting spending, another must be prepared to reduce its surplus or increase its deficit by spending more. Otherwise, total income falls, erasing the intended increase in surplus. Second, help the private sector deleverage. Domestic demand recovered swiftly in countries that cut household debt quickly. U.S. households were able to shake debt loose because of non-recourse mortgages, which are attached to the property and do not follow the mortgage holder after foreclosure. A mortgage holder in the U.S. can get rid of their debt and start afresh. A Spanish mortgage holder can be straddled with unaffordable debt for years. This is worse for banks in the long run, as it weighs on consumer spending and the broader economy, increasing their non-performing loans and decreasing the demand for credit. Changing laws is one way around this. Policymakers can also assist private sector deleveraging by allowing inflation to run high for a short period, raising money incomes relative to money debts. Third, go slow on bank recapitalization. In many jurisdictions, regulators have allowed banks to run down their capital buffers. Rebuilding these buffers only very gradually during the recovery will support demand. Banks can increase their capital ratio by raising capital or cutting back their risk-weighted assets, which in practice means reducing their lending to businesses. And fourth, keep an eye on broad money. Predictions of runaway inflation never came to fruition in the 2010s. The forecasts tended to be based on the massive expansion of central bank balance sheets, but a better guide to inflation and aggregate demand proved to be commercial bank balance sheets. Most money today is in the form of electronic deposits, which are liabilities of commercial banks. Chris co-authored another commentary this week with our chief economist and director of research, Dinai Kyriakopoulou, on debt sustainability. They wrote, "There is no doubt that we will exit the crisis with damaged economies and higher debts, but assessing how sustainable these debts are is a more nuanced exercise than stimulus critics imply. The most common measure to assess debt sustainability is the debt-to-GDP ratio, how much a country owes relative to how much it produces annually. On this metric, Japan, Greece, and Italy look particularly vulnerable. Though a critical metric, debt-to-GDP does not give the full picture. A good place to start is to look at the total economy debt or leverage, which adds household and non-financial corporates' debt to government debt. On this metric, Italy and the US look better than others. The public sector is again acting to bridge the economic shortfall from the lockdowns. Getting the sequencing right will be key to avoid the mistakes of the past crisis. Still, with some transferring to be expected, whole economy debt can act as an indicator for the risk of increase in government debt. France, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Canada look more vulnerable on this metric. Sustainability also depends on a country's saving rate, home bias of investors, and government's ability to act. If interest rates rise above growth rates, some governments will have longer to decide policy responses than others. Canada and the US have the shortest debt maturities among advanced economies. The UK is the standout performer in average debt maturity. If UK borrowing costs shot up this year, it would only impact UK interest repayments slowly. In theory, who the debt is owed to does not matter. In practice, it matters a great deal. Debt held by domestic banks risks creating sovereign doom loops. In the euro area crisis of the past decade, bailouts were created to transfer debt from private to public creditors that could, in turn, afford to ease the terms of repayment, extend maturities, and grant debt restructuring in all but name. Greece owes the majority of its debt to public institutions. There are fewer options for emerging markets. Many hold debt in foreign currencies, mostly in dollars, and have experienced sharp portfolio outflows since the start of the crisis. Local currency bonds held by foreigners have also been subject to sell-offs. With the global financial safety net incomplete, many have turned to the IMF for funding, which has a lending capacity of $1 trillion. To read the rest of Chris and Dinai's debt analysis, visit omfif.org. over on our podcast channel, be sure to listen to my colleague Helen Gibson's conversation with the Bank of England's David Bollat and Chris Peacock. They discuss central bank communications and, in particular, a report by the Bank of England and UK's Behavioural Insight Team titled Enhancing Central Bank Communications Using Simple and Relatable Information. Next week, as always, we have a full roster of virtual meetings. On Tuesday, the 5th of May, Philip Steinberg, Director General for Economic Policy at the German Federal Ministry for Economic Affairs and Energy, discusses Germany's response to the pandemic in relation to Europe-wide programmes. Also on the 5th of May, Jing Donghua, Vice President and Treasurer of the World Bank, discusses sustainable development bonds and the future of ESG investing. On Wednesday, the 6th of May, Danielle Palatai, Chief Economist and Executive Director for Economic Sciences and Priority Matters at the National Bank of Hungary, discusses the country's economic position and relationship with Europe. The same day, Sujoy Bose, Chief Executive Officer of the National Investment and Infrastructure Fund, discusses India's path to a more sustainable and resilient economy and the opportunities for infrastructure investment in India post-coronavirus. And that is all for this edition of Week in Review. To read more about everything we've discussed, visit omfif.org or scroll down to the notes underneath this podcast, where you will find links to everything mentioned today. To stay up to date with OMFIF news, analysis, and forthcoming meetings, sign up at omfif.org/subscribe. I'm Julie Lavia-Bignarli. Thank you for listening.